Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, August 7th, 2014. This is Michael Norris. As always, I am joined by my partners in crime, Jay West, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
Doing good, sir.
Well, I'm doing well. I'm sitting here with the lights flickering, with the thundering lightning going on, hoping I don't lose power. But other than that, things are fine.
Get our commercial in for you.
Right. Yeah, I can't. I didn't get my flashlight, so I couldn't see it. If we did it.
Bobby,
there?
Yeah, he's.
I'm here. I'm listening at the. I'm listening at you about the thundering and lightning. That's.
Well, you're a few miles down the road. Is it clear there?
It's not raining. It's just. I mean. Seems to be all right.
Okay. Maybe it's just around my house. You know, it's maybe the blue.
Yeah, well, you know.
You just got a dark cloud over you all the time.
Right. Well, I've got a little dog keeps in the backyard during the day, and if she hears one thunderclap, she's under the house, so I have to go under there on my hands and knees to get her out, you know, to bring her in, bring her inside. So that was my physical activity for this afternoon.
Well, before we get into the show, Jay, if you would go ahead and do
I just wanted you to say it one more time so everybody will
okay,
know.
Not a problem.
Here we go. Tonight's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/GWHradio.
Back to you,
Mike.
All right. All right, thank you, sir. You could just get better every week. before we get into our guests, we're going to have Scott Teal and Jerry Barber and possibly Buddy Wayne with us again this week to kind of continue on our conversation we started a couple weeks ago about the Welch family legacy and wrestling in Tennessee in general. And but before we get started, for those who don't know by now, and I don't want to make this maudlin or be sad or anything like that. I want to celebrate this gentleman's life, but we lost one of the greatest yesterday. Ken Lucas passed away at the end of the age of 73. I still don't know a whole lot of details as far as how it happened, what exactly happened. Know absolutely nothing about any kind of memorial arrangements or anything like that. If there will be any, I'm just not sure. But Ken was, because it was a unique person, as Jerry can tell you. I hope they allow rubber snakes up in heaven, because you know he's going to have one.
There's no doubt.
And Joe Turner was probably hiding behind the pearly gates the minute he walked through, probably clubbed him in the back of the shoulders. Oh, man.
I don't doubt that.
But Bobby and I had spaghetti for dinner tonight, and I couldn't help but think about Ken Lucas wishing you a spaghetti dinner. Jerry. Oh, man. But what a great guy he was. You know, and the thing about Ken was Ken could rib, on the level, because you just never knew when he was joking and when he wasn't. He never cracked a smile. Always had that dry wit about him, and you just never knew whether he was pulling your leg or not. Nine times out of ten, he was, but you just never could tell.
You really could. I mean, he could keep a straight face, and he could drag it out and drag it out. I mean, he was a master at it. He lived for that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I posted this today. Some of you may have saw it, and if you didn't know, and again, I'm like Michael, I don't want to make this a sad occasion. It's sad enough as it is. But when my wife passed away, the day that we had the viewing at the church, I got up early that morning, and me and my daughter went out to the funeral home, and Chuck gave me some private time with Debbie and Lisa, and you know, just let us kind of be in there by ourselves. And it was a twofold thing. It was to give me some private time, and it was also to give me a chance to look and make sure everything was like I wanted it. And when we got to the church, of course, we left and went to the church and got there early, and we went in, and there was one arrangement of flowers there. And I sat down, and as I've told everybody that I've told about this, the good Lord gave me a real sense of peace about this thing, and I had not been crying. I was very calm, and I was doing pretty good at this point. And I sat down, and I told my daughter, I said, "How about looking at the card and see who these flowers are from? They were gorgeous." And she said, "Well, I don't know these people." And I said, "Well, who are? What's the names?" And she said, "There's just three names. That's all it says. It says Joe Turner, Bill Bowman, Ken Lucas." And needless to say, gentlemen, I lost it. And that being said, I did not meet Ken Lucas. I never crossed paths with him in the business. I met him when Bill Bowman's wife Ann passed away, and it was very brief at that point. But last year when I went to Scott Till's for his reunion, I sat on the porch and talked to Ken Lucas for probably 3 hours. And what an absolute joy and a pleasure he was to sit and talk to. And from everybody I've talked to, read about, he was a Cadillac in the ring, too. So, gonna be missed by a lot of folks.
Except when he called the shots, he talked so fast it was hard to keep up with what he was wanting to do. But that was more on me than it was on him, working with him. It was a thrill for me to the one time I did work with him, because I had grown up watching him, was a big fan of Ken Lucas. And just absolutely was a thrill to be around him. And like I said, he had such a sense of humor, and you'd never know it just to if you only knew him through television, because his interviews were always dead serious and everything, and he was always fairly low key. But behind the scenes and in the dressing room, he was just always up to something. And having watched him, and it's hard for me to believe, he began his career as a heel. In fact, when he first came into Mobile, he was a heel, but that didn't last very long, and he was always a babyface from there. But he, to me, was—he's kind of like people have said about Dick Steinborn. He was the consummate babyface. I mean, he had more fire in his comebacks and everything. And a lot of people only know Ken from the tail end of his career, where he was on cable TV teaming with Ricky Morton. But Ricky, from what I understand, has given Ken total credit for everything he ever learned about the business, because I think very few people would doubt the statement that Ricky Morton is probably the best baby face of it was the best baby face of his era, as far as the getting the crowd sympathy and making those fiery comebacks and everything. And what he was at that stage is what Ken Lucas was for the majority of his career, and just an unbelievable talent,
Well, it's good that we've got a program like this where people who are not familiar with him, I'm not all that familiar with him, a little bit, but that folks can listen in and really find out something about the guy. This is one of the things, one of the unfortunate things is that we have to talk about the ones that are passing, but the fortunate thing is that we can talk about them and keep their legacy alive.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we lost one other great, and this just has nothing to do with the wrestling business, but if you grew up in Atlanta or spent any time in Atlanta or anywhere in Georgia, the name Pete Van Wieren is very familiar with you. When I first started watching the Braves in 1981, isn't that the season where they had a 15-20-game beginning of the season?
Could have been, yeah.
And I started watching them, and at that time it was Ernie Johnson, Skip Carey, and Pete Van Wieren, and that's the way it stayed for so many years. And when I moved here, still followed the Braves and everything, you know, a lot of people complain about the Braves the way they're playing this season, but they've lost, what, 8-9 games in a row, and they're still only 4 games out of first place. Those people don't remember the 80s. when you could buy a general admission seat and sit behind home plate because nobody was going to the games. But it's funny. I've started following the Braves more this year than I have in the last probably 10, 15 years. But I can still tell you the starting lineup of the 82 Braves. You guys check me and see if I get them all right. First base was Chris Chambliss. Second base was Glenn Hubbard. Shortstop, Rafael Ramirez. Third base was Bob Horner. Outfield was Brett Butler, Dale Murphy, and Claudel Washington. And the catcher was Bruce Benedict. I don't remember all of the pitchers, but the ones I remember, Pasquale Perez, Phil Negro, Bob Walk, Gene Garber, Steve Bedrosian, Rick Camp. I know we had the ugliest pitching staff I'd ever seen. And then we had Bob Watson and, what was the guy's, Jerry, can't think of his name. Was a utility player. Played just about every position. I can't think of what his name is. But anyway, I still remember those. I went to several games my first year living here, and it was what a thrill that was. Well, number one, it was a thrill to be living in a city like Atlanta that had 4 major league teams. You had the Falcons, you had the Braves, you had the Hawks, and you had the Flames.
A lot of people would argue that statement.
Which
4 major league teams?
Well, I mean, they were in major. They played. We had major. Our teams that played in the major leagues.
Well, there you go. That's better.
But I was telling Bobby, it's an odd little fact about the Braves announcers. They all died in August, and they died 3 years apart. Skip Carey died August of 2008. Ernie Johnson, August of 2011, and Pete Van Weeren, August of this year. So,
that's
in your radio days, Jay, did you ever run across any of them?
Well, Skip Carey was the one that I had the most knowledge of. You know, he started very early in Atlanta. There was a station called WAKE. And this is before the Braves came to town. And when he was very young, he got a job there. And when the Crackers were still playing, he was doing recreations of the Crackers games like they used to do on the radio when they would take it off of the broadcast wire. And that was the first job that Skip had in Atlanta. And that goes way back to the early days. So, yeah, I followed him a lot during his career from the time he worked at Channel 11 and everything else. I didn't know the other two guys that well, but I do know that, you know, how professional they were and things of that nature. But Skip Carey is the guy that was working before I was ever in the business. And I figured if you could do recreations of baseball games with a little sound effect item that sounded like the guy hitting the bat, then there must be a way to get in the business.
Absolutely.
And he took that
a
long way.
They kept mentioning the little tribute they played over the weekend during one of their games. They were talking about them being on TBS made them truly, you know, everybody's favorite team because, I mean, they had fans and still to this day have fans from all over the country that follow the Braves because of those TBS broadcasts.
Oh, absolutely. And the radio broadcast, too, that was a Clear Channel station that went all over the country.
Right. Right. Well, Jerry, well, you were not around Atlanta a lot in the early 80s. You were where in Carolinas, Kansas City? Where were you around those days?
I was back home.
Were you?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, then you were probably a Braves fan, too.
Yeah, I was always a Yankees fan.
Well, we won't hold that against you.
Well, I was wondering, Mike, what information you had to actually push out of your brain in order to remember that starting lineup from that year. I mean, that's
I don't, you know, I can't remember things from last week half the time, but I can, for some, I was just that impressed with them when I came here, even though, you know, they probably lost 110 games that season, but it was a thrill to me to be seeing Major League Baseball live and just having somebody to follow, because I wasn't a big baseball fan growing up until, you know, I started following the Braves, like I said, in 81, and then when I moved here in 82, I just kept up with them. When they went to the World Series, I went to two games. My daughter and I went to two World Series games the year they won, in fact, 95, but I was not there the game where they won the title, but I did see them, you know, a couple of games during that run or that World Series. And, you know, like I said, what a difference from, you know, going in 83 and 84. I was there for the when they brought Negro back for the one game only, his retirement night. I was there for that game. I was there for the game that started on the 4th of July and ended on the 5th of July.
Yes.
Bobby was probably there whenever they'd have wrestling matches, either before or after the Braves game.
I did one of those
there twice.
I did one of those with Freddie. He was up in the booth, and yeah, we were down there, you know, on the outfield. And I remember Tommy Rich was on that show, and yeah, a lot of folks stayed around for the wrestling matches after the game was over.
Well, back in those days, it was probably smart to put the wrestling on last. That way, they made sure everybody stayed.
Yeah, well, they did. They had a good crowd for it.
Good. And they mentioned something on that evidently happened before I came to Atlanta, talking about Pete Van Weeren pushing a peanut with his nose down the first baseline and riding a donkey down Peachtree Street. And I don't know anything about all that. I'm assuming that was some sort of publicity things they were doing.
When they were so bad, it was equivalent to a promoter trying to hotshot a territory where they do all kind of stupid stuff just to draw a crowd. That's what Ted Turner did when he bought it.
Yeah.
He had ostrich races.
Yes.
He had he would have professional golfers come in and hit balls from home plate to a flag out in center field. He had Carl Wallenda. I saw Carl Wallenda walk across Atlanta Stadium. I mean, just all sorts of stuff he did to try to draw people there. And you know, it was it's just like anything else. If you win, they will come. If they don't win, I don't care what you do, they're not going to come.
Yeah, that's true.
One of the most positive things that came out of that era, Bobby, and you know it, was doing those games. Ted Turner put together a top-notch production team from cameramen to audio on back all the way to the director's chair doing those games.
Yep. The guy that one of the guys that directed our show for a lot of years, Skip Ellison, he left there and went to Chicago, and he directed tons of the Cubs games on WGN. Just there was a lot of guys got their feet wet here in Atlanta on that Turner station, and went on to big things.
Well, I don't know if you count the Cubs as going on to a big thing, but
I'm not sure the Cubs is, but going to WGN in Chicago
was
a big thing.
Yes.
I'm sure. Well, guys, I want to get into back on subject to our wrestling show here. Let me get our guests on the line with us. First up is our friend Scott Teal, author par excellence and publisher and chief bottle washer at Crowbar Press. Scott, how you doing this evening?
I think I've got the wrong number. I didn't hear it. Pro Baseball Pandemonium.
Jerry Barber's also with us. Let me get him on with us. The Tennessee gentleman from Kingsport, Tennessee. Jerry,
you got
with
the
us?
Town wrong. Yeah, I'm with you.
Dyersburg. That's what one was I thinking. Kingsport. I know. I talked to Bo James 7, and that had me thinking of Kingsport. Dyersburg, Tennessee.
Yep.
That's right.
Dyersburg, Tennessee. Right.
Those are fight words.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's like Alabama and Auburn. You know, we keep pushing. And the state of Alabama keeps pushing Auburn closer and closer to Georgia, and Georgia keeps pushing back, trying to keep them over in Alabama. So, well, how are you gentlemen doing this evening?
I'm doing
great.
Good. You're welcome to the show.
I appreciate the honor to be on the show.
Oh, it's an honor to have you on. And we got Bobby Simmons, who you know. Jay West, who
yes.
I don't think you ever crossed paths with Jay. Jay was the TV ring announcer and did house shows all around Atlanta for Georgia Championship Wrestling. And Jerry Oates is also with us. I don't know if you and Jerry ever worked anywhere, maybe for Bill Golden.
No, I don't. Yeah, Bill Golden. Yeah, I worked with Bill Golden for several years, and I remember Jerry Oates.
But it
was long ago. He might not remember me, though, see.
I do.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great.
And,
good.
Jerry, this is Jay West. I certainly never crossed paths with you, but I saw your name and on many programs and in many wrestling magazines, so I'm certainly familiar with your career, and it's a great opportunity. I'm glad to get the opportunity to talk to you tonight and have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to say it's an honor to be invited to be on the show.
Well, this is Bobby, and it's really not that big a deal to me.
Listen to you, man.
Jerry, how are you, my friend?
Fine, doing great. And
good,
hey, before we get through now, you're going to do old friends, right?
Yeah.
They may not know what I'm talking about. But
oh, yeah, we know, and it's more often than he'd like to do it, I think.
Yeah, really. Absolutely.
Oh.
Yeah.
And it gets tougher every time because...
Yes, sir. And Scott, I saw Scott, I saw some of the information you put out on Facebook today on Ken Lucas, and once again, just thank you for all that you do to keep the wrestling fans of bygone days in the know about our heroes.
Thank you, Jay. It's what I love doing, and I hope I'm going to just be able to continue doing it here on out. And once I retire in a year, end of next year, I'll be really cranking out a lot of stuff. But, yeah, it was tough to really post that information today about Ken. It's sort of like Bobby said earlier, you know, Dennis Hall, Joe Turner, and Ken Lucas were three of the people I was almost closest to ever. And this one was really, really tough. I talked to Ken fairly regular and had the honor of having him at our reunion 2 years in a row. And as a result, Ken just refused to attend any of the reunions, and it was, like I said, it was such an honor for him to come here 2 years ago. But through my reunions, if nothing else came of it, it got him down to the Gulf Coast reunion this past year, and so some of the people there hadn't seen him in 35 years or more, and it was just great when he showed up in Mobile at the racetrack this past year.
Yeah, what you had posted, I thought I knew everything there was to know about Ken, but I had no clue that he worked in Pittsburgh, and certainly never knew that he worked in the South Pacific.
Yeah, it was interesting when he told me that. Those of you who have read Don Fargo's book, Fargo met Jim Dalton up there in Pittsburgh, and Dalton was actually wrestling as Jimmy Dykes.
Right.
And when they left, Ken went in there and is one of the along with Mickey Sharp took their place in the Pittsburgh territory for Toots Mont. And I didn't know that. I didn't know a lot of this. I talked to Ken and just got that information for the Slammogram program I put out when I gave him the Crowbar Press Award 2 years ago here at our reunion. And Ken and I had plans to do a full-blown interview, maybe even a book in the next few months, and I'm so sad that didn't come about. Of all people who should have a book written about him, or at least a lengthy interview, it'd be Ken Lucas, because he had a storied career, and a lot of people around the world, around the United States, don't even know who he is. But in the Gulf Coast, in Texas, in Louisiana, Tennessee, just all through here, I mean, he was the man. In Phoenix, he was the man. In fact,
yep.
That's where he actually got his career, you know, really kicked off.
Yeah, and he began, he started strong. He was holding championships within the first year of his career, starting, you know, the Western States Tag Team Champions he held with two or three different partners. I don't know if that was based out of Amarillo or or Arizona, but I know he and Red Steiner held it. He and Art Nelson, he and Sputnik, he and Mike DiBiase. I mean, he was just, you know, he began right there with the big stars and just made an impact right away, and he certainly made an impact when he came to Mobile territory for the first time, and I'm sure he did in Tennessee as well.
And, yeah, he spent a
Jerry,
lot of
I know
time
you teamed with him some. Jerry yes, Barber.
Yes, I did.
Teamed with him.
Yes, I did, and what a great person he was in the ring and outside the ring, too. We ran a lot of miles together up and down the road in the Tennessee territory, and I learned a lot from Ken. And he was very much a professional person.
Yeah.
He knew what to say and when to say and when to do it and when to not do it. And he had taught me a lot along those lines in the business.
Yeah.
He didn't happen to invite you over for a spaghetti dinner, did he?
Well, I've been there and done that. He was staying in Nashville, and his wife was still living at that time, and we'd come home one night from Birmingham or somewhere, and he said, "Hey, come on in, Jerry." He called me Barber Pole back then because my last name's Barber. Come on in. Boy, she had a big spaghetti dinner cooked. That was wonderful.
But at least you got to eat yours. He made Jerry wait till two. Jerry Oates wait till 3 in the morning.
Oh, really?
He sure did.
I don't doubt that either. And I see what he would do, too. And he was such a kidder. You'd be making a trip with him. And when you got back home from your trip, he'd have you hating your wife and everybody else when you got home. Ribbing you so hard about everything.
he was something else. Well, Scott, I'm going to kind of turn it over to you because I know you had some things you want to discuss with Jerry about his Jerry Barber. This is going to be confusing with Jerry Barber about his career. So,
well, I just thought we'd all talk, sort of pick up where we left last week. Jerry grew up in Dyersburg, or you were born in Dyersburg, and I guess you actually grew up there, didn't you, Jerry?
Yes, I did. I grew up in Dyersburg.
Yeah, just tell a little bit about how you came in touch with the Welches, and then we can get jump it right back into talking about the Welch family.
Okay, well, Herb Welch and his wife, Reba, were good friends with my mother and father. And I spent a lot of time at Herb and Reba's house growing up, and it was just a thing that I was going to do, be in the wrestling business. And I knew all the Welches, was with them through a lot of years, and Herb and Reba were very good to me, and I had a good mother and daddy, don't misunderstand me now, but they just sort of took a liking to me. I don't know why, but they did, and like I say, my mother and daddy and Herb and Reba were real good friends, and we just got started that way. When I was, I'm going to say, 5-6 years old, Herb would come by and pick me up and take me on trips with him, and it just, you know, I thought I was, man, I was a big dog then, and so here I am with Herb Welch. Going to the town. And, that's just what I was going to do when I grew up.
What did your parents think about it? Were they okay with you getting into wrestling?
Yeah, they were okay because of their relationship with the Welches also.
Yeah. Now, you started out as a referee, right?
Yes, uh-huh. I started out as a referee. I refereed my first match in Blytheville, Arkansas.
What year was that, Jerry?
That was in 1963.
Now, you weren't even out
you
of high
guys,
school then.
Do any of you guys remember Chico Cortez?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Chico and Frank Martinez were working, wrestling with someone, and I disqualified them. Chico grabbed me, boy, and he busted me. I thought, man, this is the way it is. But, it was the best thing that ever happened to me in the business, though. Said, hey, you better be able to take care of yourself when you get in there. And I was a senior in high school then.
Were you a little bit more on guard after that point about what these guys might do to you as a ref?
This is correct. And then when I started wrestling, I didn't referee very much. I started wrestling, and I was really on my guard then because, as you guys know, you have to be able to take care of yourself. In those days, you did. But you never know what town you're going to, what territory you're going to, and somebody might not like you.
Yep.
Yep.
And Jerry Oates can vouch for that, I know.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, right. I did start out refereeing.
I think it's interesting that you were actually refereeing before you got out of high school. Did that sort of make you a sort of a celebrity in your school?
Yeah, you know, it was... the people sort of looked up to me, and then I refereed some in Dyersburg and a few other towns around that they'd know about. And they sort of looked up to me, and I appreciated that.
Right. Now, you went to school to Memphis State, and you didn't wrestle at Memphis State, or did you?
Yes, I was on the first wrestling team that Memphis State had in the fall of 1964. I graduated from high school in 64 and started at Memphis State. And the wrestling coach was Billy Finch, not the basketball coach. But then that's where I went to my college career.
Uh-huh.
And my mother and daddy really wanted me to go to school. And, of course, by then I was wrestling, and I was getting booked, fortunate to get booked. I thought, well, I'm going to quit school, you know. I'm going to wrestle, man. And, of course, Roy Welch and Nick Gulas were the promoters in the Tennessee area. And one day I told my dad, you know, hey, I'm going to quit and start wrestling full time. So he didn't want me to do that. And so one weekend I came home, and I'll never forget it. Herb and Roy came up to my dad's house in Dyersburg. And I said, well, you know, I want to be booked, you know, all the time. Roy said, no, I said, you need to go to school, you know, get your education. If you get your education, no one can take that away from you. And I said, well, I'll just go to another territory. He said, no, son, I don't think you will do that either. Because at that time, you know, a promoter could blackmail you if he wanted to. So, I was thankful for that advice. I got my education, and I'm very thankful for it now. I hope that makes sense to someone.
Oh, absolutely. It made sense.
Right. Well, that was everybody's dream that got involved with, or, you know, interested in wrestling. And I think everybody at one time or another wanted to be a part of it in some fashion or another.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Tell me about Mike, do you have some questions about the Welch family that Jerry might be able to... I know we learned something last week about Joanne Phillips we didn't realize.
Yeah, because I was always under the impression that she was Jack's daughter and she was actually his sister-in-law. I did not know that. Buddy told us that. Well, not necessarily about the Welch in general, but I know in the 70s you came in to Lee's territory and did some shots over in Mississippi. Was there ever any thought of coming and spending more time in Mobile?
Yes, it was, but for some reason I was just always drawn back to Tennessee for some reason. And I grew up with Lee and Bobby and Don, more with Bobby because Don and Lee was older than I was.
Right.
And if they wanted something done, Lee would call me and say, hey, you know, need you to take care of this for me. And gentlemen, I'm not bragging on myself. Please don't think that. But and I would go down and do what he needed me to do. And if I wanted to come down and work some shots, then I'd always call him and he would say, yeah, you know, whatever you want to do. But I just never was drawn to come down and work the Mobile territory.
Well, you'd have fit right in, I can tell you that. We had a lot of guys that, unfortunately, not too many people know about that territory because of Lee kind of wouldn't let outsiders you know, do magazine articles and stuff like that. I think he wound up regretting it at the end, but that was just a territory that was not that well known, and there's not a whole lot of video, you know, available on that territory. But having grown up there and seen everybody that came through there, it was an amazing group. It was an amazing group, and we had a lot of people come through that you wouldn't think about, especially back before I was even born. We had stars like Argentina Rocca, Freddie Blassie was in there all the time, Gorgeous George. In fact, Gorgeous George was the Gulf Coast champion for a while. Mm-hmm. And so we had them all come through there, and good core group of guys, you know, besides Lucas, we had Dick Dunn, Don Carson, Greg Peterson, all great workers. That all of them worked up there in Tennessee as well, so I know you're familiar with all of them. And just a great bunch of guys that worked that territory. And I can't think of a better territory to grow up watching. Now, the you know, the television production wasn't like Georgia Championship Wrestling on TBS. The wrestling wasn't as technical as Florida, and I loved both of those territories when I would you know, travel in the summers. But Mobile was still my heart, so, and still is. As far as not the city, but the territory. The city, I wouldn't give you $2.50 to the deed to it. But,
you know, it was my relationship with the Welches goes so big with Lee and Don and Bobby and all. And, you know, Lee, when we were growing up, you know, helped me too when I was trying to break in. He taught me a lot about what to do and not to do also. But, my mentor was Herb Welch. And I had a lot of other guys, too. I don't know if Buddy Wayne's on the phone yet or not, but...
No, he hasn't joined us yet.
Okay, but, you know, Buddy was good also, you know. So when I was booking for Bill Gold in Montgomery, Dick Dunn, Greg Peterson were up there, you know, wrestling for us then. So, you know, it's... I've had a great life in the business, and I cherish it so much, and so many good friends, and, you know, like I say, Joe Turner and Ken Lucas both gone, they were great friends of mine, and you guys are great friends, and Jerry Oates and I go back a lot of years, and I just appreciate everyone. You know, I couldn't have done anything in the wrestling business without the guys I wrestled with, and I appreciate it so much from every one of them.
Great. Jerry, how come I always wonder why Herb Welch didn't become more involved with promotion. I know he promoted, you know, some of the smaller towns in Dyersburg. Did he actually promote Dyersburg?
Yes, he promoted Dyersburg in the later years of Dyersburg, and he promoted Viable, Arkansas. Viable, Arkansas on a weekly basis, and Dyersburg, too, at the end of it. In Dyersburg, you know, while it was still territories, he promoted Dyersburg.
So he was he more interested in wrestling, though? Because it seems like, you know, he was a big name, and even in Nashville for a long time. And
oh yes, he was all over the Tennessee territory, wherever it was. He was, you know, he was over with the fans and everything. And Herb, you know, he drew a lot of money. He drew a lot of people in his day and time. And one thing about the wrestling business, I hear people say now, well, they drew, you know, $50,000 here. Well, at the prices of tickets in today's time, there might not be as many people as we had at matches.
Yeah.
So the tickets were not as much, and we drew as many people a lot of time. Of course, it wasn't as much money then because the tickets didn't cost that much. But it was great, you know, and the first booking office for this territory was in Dyersburg, and it was the Mid-South Booking Office. It was at the old East Court Street Arena there in Dyersburg. I don't know if any of you guys ever heard of Mid-South Booking or East Court Street Arena in Dyersburg.
Oh, yeah, Mid-South Booking, absolutely.
That's where this territory got started, was right there in Dyersburg. I'm talking about the Tennessee territory.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about East Court Street Arena. What was that like? Was it a big place, or was it, what kind of building was it?
It was a block building, and it probably held 1,000 people.
Wow, that's a lot.
That don't, you know, that don't mean it's sold out 1,000 people every week. I remember it ran on Tuesday night for years and years and years when I was growing up, and a lot of time on Sunday afternoons. You guys remember an old boy by the name of Joe Carr? Anyone?
Yes.
I remember the name, yeah.
Yeah, he and some other fellows like Joe McCarthy was from Dyersburg. They would work out with a lot of the guys like myself, and Buddy Wayne had been down there working out some with them too on Sunday afternoons.
Now, was Joe Carr any relation to Charlie Carr?
I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Charlie Carr.
Charlie,
I called the wrong name.
Okay.
Charlie Carr, excuse me, please.
Yeah, I've heard some stories about Charlie Carr that would curl your hair.
Oh, yes, sir. A lot of them, truthfully, what a tough guy he was, you know.
Now, Bunk Harris was from Dyersburg, too, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, uh-huh. Yes, his name was George Harris.
Right.
He was from Dyersburg, and he and when he got into the wrestling business, he and Buddy Fuller were good friends. And that's how he got started in the business.
Now, how did you, when you were a kid there, was George Harris older than you?
Yes, George Harris was probably maybe 10 years older than me.
Okay. He was more, I guess, Buddy Fuller's age, wasn't he?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, he was.
Okay.
The last year Bunk came to the Mobile reunion, here again, as a kid growing up in Atlanta, you know, Bunk was a mainstay here. He worked here as the baby blimp. And he would
right. He
would be in and out and in and out and in and out. But I just had a chance to sit and talk to him and just kind of pick his brain a little. And you mentioned, he told me, he said, people used to, he said, guys in the business always, oh, here comes Fuller's man. He told me, I was a Buddy Fuller man. He said, everywhere I went for Buddy Fuller, I made money. He said, Buddy took care of me, and I made money. And he said, bottom line in this business is going to the bank. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, they can call me what they want to. He said, but everywhere I went, he said, Buddy helped me make money. So, you know, that's you talk about him being friends. That's a good testament to that.
That's great. And they were very good friends, you know.
Now they had
somebody else, I'm not sure if he was from Dyersburg or where he was from. Up that way, I know, was Rocky McGuire.
Yeah, he's from Dyersburg.
Is he?
Yeah. I never knew that.
Yeah, he was from Dyersburg.
I thought he was because he came when the Buddy was running Mobile before he sold it to Lee. Rocky started out as a referee, and then he was the promoter of record for several occasions, and then he wound up staying down there and, you know, running the Dothan Panama City end of the territory. And he and Don Carson were lifetime buddies. I don't know how they, because Don, I know, was from Cleveland originally, but I'm sure they crossed paths somewhere along the line, and they stayed friends until Rocky's passing, I guess, because Rocky was a character, too.
Oh, yeah. And like I say, he was from Dyersburg, and he had a brother by the name of J.R. McGuire that refereed a lot in the Tennessee territory years ago. And they were both from Dyersburg. At one time in this business, when there were territories, you could go to any territory and there would be at least one guy there from Dyersburg. I'm talking about like in the 60s and early 70s. There'd be one man from Dyersburg there.
Was that the quota?
Do I know?
Was that the quota?
Well, that was the start.
you were the guy from Dyersburg. I'm sorry, you can't come in until the next guy leaves. But
No,
I think that really just talks about how much talent you had come out of the area, you know, and the influence of the Welches there, and you know, and the fact that folks believed it, and they enjoyed it. And if they had the opportunity and the ability, then they wanted to get into the business. And that's what you wanted to do, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Oh, yes. I much wanted to do that because of growing up with the Welchers.
Right.
And, you know, there were other guys I mentioned a while ago. Joe McCarthy, his real name was Albert Crystal from Dyersburg. And he worked in the Mobile territory when Lee and him went down there, and probably some for Buddy Fuller, too, down there.
Yes, he did. Worked under both names, as a matter of fact. In fact, worked an early part of 55 as Albert, Fearless Al Criswell is what they called him, and then he came back later on the same year, and he was all of a sudden Joe McCarthy. And I always thought that that may have been a takeoff on the senator from Minnesota, but I found out he was using that name before the politician Joe McCarthy ever came along.
And, yeah, you're course, right. I think you're right.
Yeah, that goes
and,
back.
Of course, Joe also had a run with the NWA World Junior Heavyweight Championship out in Oklahoma. And,
yeah, he worked a lot for Leroy McGurk, and they introduced him as Joe McCarthy, the coon hunter from Tiger Tail, Tennessee. Which was, Tiger Tail is a little community right outside of Dyersburg. They would call him the coon hunter from Tiger Tail, Tennessee.
Now, Jerry, it's something you may be able to answer that we a couple of weeks ago when we were talking, since you were so close to the family. Do you have any idea what brought the Welchers out of Bahuska, Oklahoma, into Tennessee?
Yeah, well, of course, actually, they came here from Borger, Texas. They were in Bahuska,
really?
And then in Borger, Texas. And Herb and Roy were working in oil fields out there. And for entertainment, they had wrestling just between the guys in the oil fields. And for some reason, Roy got in contact with somebody here in Tennessee in Dyersburg. And he came, and then he brought Herb with him. And they started having matches, first of all, in a little community outside of Dyersburg called Southtown. Then they moved to an old cigar factory building that had closed down, and it just grew from there.
What year would that have been, Jerry?
That would have been back in the 40s.
Okay, just trying to get a chronological look at how this thing developed here.
Right, I understand. But that would have been back in the 40s.
Early I wish 40s. We had better records of the matches that were held, you know, in that area, in the Dyersburg area, and those early matches, but they just weren't fans in that. Most of the records we have, and Mike can attest to this, comes from wrestling fans who kept those records and would send their friends little newsletters or things like that, and that's where we've got a lot of our records. But I'm sure in Dyersburg they just didn't have anybody that did anything like that, so a lot of that is lost. And I don't know if the newspapers there even have their old newspapers on microfilm where somebody could go research that. But I'd love to come out there sometime and just see if any of the libraries have any old newspapers from the 40s and see if they. Of course, I don't even know if they even advertised in the paper back then. Back then, they probably just used window posters.
Yeah, I know they used the window cards and probably not a whole lot of newspapers.
Yeah.
Probably the best chance you would get on that would be if you were, if you were on friendly terms with the local newspaper, and you might have a result type deal. And if that was the case, then if the newspaper was friendly from those terms, newspapers then didn't come out every day, so it's hard to say. But it's possible there might be in some of those old newspapers some results of some of those shows. It's just a puzzle, trying to put things like that together.
Yeah,
I'm sure it is.
I don't even know if Dyersburg would have had a newspaper, that far back. I don't know how far back. They had one called the Star Gazette, but I don't know how far back.
It's called the State Gazette.
Oh, or State Gazette. That's right. I knew it was something Gazette. Yes.
I know it's still in publication, but I don't know how far back it goes.
Right. Interesting. Do you remember a guy named Sunset Carson, an old Western movie star?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Ed.
Tell me, what do you remember about him? He used to referee a lot. He was actually married to Violet Vian, the girl wrestler, for a while.
Yeah, the last thing I remember on Sunset Carson is they brought him in as a special referee in Dyersburg over to Old East Court Street Arena.
You guys got him. Mobile got Crash Corrigan.
Yeah, that's true. Now, there was George Harris once told me there was an open-air arena of some kind in Dyersburg. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah, they had a... at one time, they had a big baseball team in Dyersburg, and it was at a place called Burnham, B-U-R-N-H-A-M, Field. And they would have matches there.
Uh-huh.
At that time, Philip Golden was the promoter in Dyersburg. I mean, he worked for Roy and Nick, but he was the promoter, Dyersburg promoter. Bill Golden's brother, Bill. And he'd have matches out at the ballpark.
Why would Phil be promoting when Herb was there? Was Herb on the road or something a lot?
Herb was, that time, when I'm talking about, Herb was on the road.
Okay.
He was working for the Tennessee Territory, but, you know, he was wrestling on the road.
Did Phil ever wrestle?
Phil Golden? No.
Yeah, Phil, yeah. Now, how did they get involved in pro wrestling? Do you know?
Yeah, Golden, Phil's brother, married Roy Webster's daughter.
Right, and then, and of course, Bill Golden, he refereed, he promoted,
he
booked territories, and of course, Jimmy Golden was his son, and,
that's correct, when,
and then Phil, I didn't know Phil ever did anything until he opened up Paducah, running opposition.
Yes, he did, he ran Dyersburg at one time, and, Bill, when it was Mid-South booking office in Dyersburg, Bill worked in the booking office for Roy there. You know, booking towns and so forth like that.
And, Bill was also, Bill promoted Florence, Alabama, right, if I'm not mistaken, before he went down into Louisiana with Lee.
Yeah, right, uh-huh. And Bill was married to Roy's daughter, Ruby.
Right.
Now, Phil Golden, actually, when you you worked a full-time job for the first 3 or 4 years you were wrestling, but and wrestled part-time, but you was the Paducah, working Paducah for Phil Golden? Was that the first territory you actually went out and sort of spread your wings?
Yeah, that's the first territory I worked outside of Tennessee Territory. I was vice president of Security State Bank and working, wrestling part-time. Then Phil got that going while I was working for him, part-time. And then he got it going good enough before I went up there full-time for him.
Well, you're the second wrestler banker that I've ever met, Bruce Austin being the first.
I know Bruce. I know Bruce. I met Bruce when I was working for Bill Golden in Montgomery.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Bruce.
Talked to him just yesterday. His health isn't real good. He fell or something.
I hate to hear that.
He's sort of recovering. But now, how did Phil Golden break away? I mean, he sort of broke away from Welch and Gulas, didn't he, Jerry? How did all that happen? Because he was opposition.
Well, he was promoting Paducah, just Paducah, okay? And they would book guys in there for him. And then everybody different would show up. So not the guys who was booked and advertised and everything. And they were fixing to open up a... Channel 6 was in Paducah, the big TV station there. And they were going to open up another TV station. Phil got wind of that. And he got him a program, a wrestling program, on. It was channel 29, I believe, there back in 71 or 2, maybe 3. And, you know, he got his TV going, and he started running spot shows, and he just quit, you know, letting... He had the authority and all that stuff, whatever he needed to do. And he just got his own boys in there, own wrestlers in there, and he just had his own little territory there. He ran
wow.
Paducah, he ran Cape Girardeau, Missouri, he ran Sykeston, Missouri, wow. and then he would run spot shows the other nights that fed off of the new TV station.
Now, when you first
he had a pretty good crew in there. I mean, besides you, he had LaVon Stone was there, the Von
right.
Brauners with Weingroff.
Yeah.
Jim Dalton and the third Jack Dalton, who was his actual brother, Jack Bogus, was
yeah,
there. Maxie
right.
York was there.
Max York was there.
Dale Mann, I think, was there.
Yeah, yeah. They're right.
And Paul Christie, I think, was their big baby face. And
yeah,
but it was a good territory and had a lot of good talent.
Mm-hmm.
And, when you first went there, Jerry, in 1970, when you first went to Paducah, was he considered opposition at the time, or was he still sort of promoting through Welch Gulas?
No, when I first went there, he was not considered opposition because he was still booking his talent through Gulas and Welch.
Okay.
But they got, like I say, you know, they're booking guys, and of course, be a whole different crew when they got there and all that stuff. And he was smart enough to get in with the TV. That really what helped him was the TV.
That came along at just the right time for him, right?
Yes, it did.
Well, I can remember during that time period, that's the first I really learned anything about the Goldens. I was quite a wrestling fan during that period, and the Wrestling News, which was doing regional reports at that time, which was one of the more legitimate type magazines, they ran reports on the various promotions, you know, in the different areas, and one of the ones that they mentioned were the guys that were working for the Goldens during that time, which I thought was interesting because they were bringing some very good talent into that area against what would have been the NWA promotion.
Yeah, Angelo Papo was there at that time, too.
Right.
That's right. That's right. He was, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Sure was.
And another name that just hit me, Jerry Myatt. I know he worked that territory.
Yes, he did.
And
Jerry,
a lot of those guys, at one time or another, spent time in Mobile. So I was familiar with those names when I'd see them in the wrestling magazines and everything because they had come through Mobile at times. So it was a good crew that he had. Was Saul booking for that territory?
When Saul and Kurt and Carl came down, Saul started booking. And I had no problem. Didn't have any problems with Saul or anything. Bill had a heart attack. And you know, and it sort of slowed him down and got him out of it. You know. Of course, Bill asked me. He said, "Do you want to come to Montgomery and you know book for me?" And Robert Fuller had been down there booking, and he just left. And I said, well, yeah, you know, because I could sort of see the writing on the wall of that little territory. And then I went down with Bill. No hard feelings with anyone about anything. And the book for Bill down there 3 or 4 years in Montgomery.
That was another good territory that a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah, we had a good little territory there, you know. We ran Columbus, Mississippi on Monday, Montgomery on Tuesday, Tuscaloosa on Wednesday, Anniston on Thursday, Spot Show on Friday, and then Selma, Alabama on Saturday.
Jerry, on Phil Goldman, I hate to go back, but we'll go back, get back to Montgomery. When he broke away on his own, what were the things, I mean, how did the attitude change when you were around Nick, any of the Gulas guys? Was there a lot of heat there over the fact that he did that?
a lot of heat with the wrestlers?
Yeah.
No, not that I know of.
Well, with the promotion, did you have any problem, you know, with, if you ever saw Nick or anything, was he upset with you that you went with Phil Gold?
No, Herb and Roy didn't have any animosity there, or if there'd been animosity there, then Nick would never brought me to Nashville when he did, to work in the office.
Right. Yeah. I was wondering if at the time whether they were, you know, with the, you know, how things were going, because I know they didn't like, you know, opposition being in there.
Sure. Well, one thing that Bill Golden told me, they had gone to the NWA convention, and Bill had went, Nick, Roy, and Jerry Jarrett. And Bill said, told them at the convention, says, I want to bring Jerry Barber down here, you know, to book for me. Now, this is what Bill Golden told him.
Yeah.
And he said that Jerry told him, he said, well, that's a good thing. Said, you need somebody down there now with some new ideas and so forth. So I don't know if they did that just to get me away from the Paducah operation, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, it worked out good for me. I put it that way. Don't get me wrong now, gentlemen. Don't get me wrong, gentlemen, again. I'm not bragging on myself, okay?
Sure.
Just what went down.
If they did it for that reason, it didn't matter because you stayed in Montgomery for quite a while, so they didn't just bring you there and then dump you, so you must have been doing something right.
Well, yeah.
You had mentioned running spot shows on Friday night when you were booking out of Montgomery.
Yes, sir.
Was Friday night just not a big wrestling night for one of the main cities? Was that why that was decided to do that?
Well, it would have been a big night, but we just was a small territory, and we didn't have another big town that close like the ones I had mentioned to run regular on a weekly basis. So we'd run little towns like Alexander City and places like that you probably could not have run on a weekly basis.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
All right. Well, we're at the halfway point here, and I know, Jerry Oates, you got to go. You got an early call in the morning, so as always, I thank you for being on with us. And I know you got to get up and run moonshiners in the morning on Tybee Island.
It was good hearing Scott and Jerry's voices again.
Hey,
Jerry, good
Jerry.
I'm sorry we didn't. Yeah, sorry we took all your time. I didn't know you had to go, or I'd let you jump.
That's all right. That's all right. No. Y'all got something interesting going. That's fine. And
hey,
I just think that
Jerry Oates.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Hey, man, it's nice. I go say seeing you, but we're not seeing you, but it's nice talking to you again, man.
Nice hearing your voice, Jerry.
All right.
You guys have a good evening here.
All right, Jerry.
You too, Jerry.
Good night, Jerry.
Catch you next week.
Good night.
And while we're at it, Jay, you want to give us another word from our sponsor?
Well,
so your lights go out?
A little flickering here, but it's not because I didn't pay the bill, okay? Here we go. The Peach State Pandemonium Podcast is happy to be sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on now. And if you sign up at our URL, which is audibletrial.com/GWHradio, you'll get one free audio book and a one-month trial of the service. Back to you, Mike.
Poor Ted Knight's got nothing on you, I tell you.
Yeah, this is what I'm down to now. Not that there's anything wrong with this, but I get 2 minutes a week with the voice. There you go.
Oh, man.
Jerry,
well, back to the watches. I mean, Jay was talking about, and Jerry was talking about, they're in just about every territory, there's at least one guy from Dyersburg. You think of all the states in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s that had a Welch either booking or promoting or something. You had Buddy in Florida, Lester in Florida, both of them in Georgia, the Fields, of course, along the Gulf Coast. Bill Golden, and I count him as part of the Welch family since he was married to Ruby Welch. Bill, his brother Phil, and you had Herb and Jack and Roy. And did Lester ever book any towns or promote any towns besides the Florida, Georgia area? Did he book anything up there?
Lester booked the Tennessee territory one time.
Oh, good. And then, of course, you get into Ron Fuller, and he was very successful in West Palm Beach, Florida, and then, of course, bought Knoxville from John Kazana, and eventually bought Mobile from Lee, and just continued on. And you think all the states that those promotions covered, and most people think of Tennessee, but you're talking about Missouri, Indiana, Kentucky, you know, Mississippi.
At one time, you could have said almost all the Southeast, you know?
Yep.
Right.
That's a lot of power.
Yeah,
a lot of prestige.
I want to stress. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, what was the difference in age between you and Ron and Robert Fuller?
I was probably 4 or 5 years older than them.
Uh-huh. Do you remember hanging out with them, or were you friends with them while you were growing up?
Well, they had Buddy had, you know, he ran Australia and Mobile, you know, and places like that, and they had moved around a whole lot, but we were together some, you know.
Yeah.
Not on a regular basis.
Yeah. Okay. And, how about Montgomery? What towns were you booking when you were booking for Bill Golden there?
For Bill Golden?
Uh-huh.
Like I said, Columbus, Mississippi, Montgomery, Alabama, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Anniston, Alabama, Selma, Alabama, and then a spot show on Friday night. We're in Selma on Saturday.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
So was that Saturday night, was that a good night?
That was a good night in Selma, yeah. And Selma got a TV station about that time, too. We played our tapes on there, and we'd do a live interview on Saturday afternoon. Wrestle at the National Guard Armory.
Did you cut
there again,
promos?
A whole lot of talent there.
Did you cut different promos out of Montgomery for the different shows around the circuit?
Well, what we did at that time, after the match Monday night in Columbus, Mississippi, we'd go by the TV station and we would cut promos for the next Monday night.
Okay.
Of course, we taped matches in Montgomery and we did promos for that. And we did the same thing with Tuscaloosa. And Anniston, after the matches, we would go by the TV station, cut promos for the next week.
So that was, after the matches, that was a pretty long night for some of the guys and then have to make the next town, right?
Yeah, well, but now those towns, you got to remember, were not that far apart. Because
that was the longest trip.
The longest trip was 150 miles, which was from Montgomery to Columbus, Mississippi on Monday night. Of course, Tuesday night we were in Montgomery. Wednesday night was in Tuscaloosa, which was 100 miles. Thursday night, Anniston, which was 100 miles. Saturday night, Selma, which was about 75 miles. So it didn't have a lot of miles in the territory.
And when did you do the regular TV show?
At Montgomery on Wednesday mornings.
So if you actually did the matches on Wednesday morning?
The TV matches on Wednesday morning.
Yeah, so that's interesting. How would you attract an audience to come in for the show on a Wednesday morning? Was that tough?
No, not really. All you have to do is tell them, hey, we're going to do some live matches at the TV station, and it's free.
And they figure out a way to be there.
They figure out a way to be there.
Okay.
Free will work every time.
That's right.
As Richard Pryor used to say, people will line up for free.
Yes. Jerry, at one time, they had Nick was running in 1966. Nick was running two shows in Nashville. Do you remember that? Anything about that? I don't know if it was actually Nick. I just remember like Al Costello was in here working for Nick, and then they had another show on. I can't remember what night it was, but it was like they'd run Nashville one night, two nights later they'd run Nashville, and then two nights later they'd run at the Hippodrome. Was that all Nick and Roy promoting two shows a week, or was that another group?
That had to be another group because I don't remember them. You know, them doing running Nashville two nights a week.
Yeah. The smaller group ran like Tretch Phillips, Doug Lindsay. I know Don Green worked for them. I don't know. It's just sort of a smaller, you know, Fargo was still with the big show. But I didn't know if you knew about that or what, you know, what that was all about.
I can't comment on that because I don't know a whole lot about it.
Okay. All right. Mike, something I was curious about, I don't know if Jerry would know anything, but what happened to Johnny and Marshall Fields?
Well,
one
of them was. Johnny Wayne Fields, who was Don's son. Marshall Fields, and I don't know that this was his real name, but he was better known in Mobile as Buddy Carson. He was a referee and wrestled every once in a while. That was Don Fields' brother-in-law. So I know they booked Field them as either brothers or cousins, but they were actually uncle and nephew.
Huh.
And I don't know whatever became of Buddy, but Johnny lives in Pensacola, and the last I heard managed a very nice seafood restaurant over there, but wants nothing to do with the wrestling business.
Wow. They didn't wrestle that long, did they?
Johnny did. Johnny wrestled, he started refereeing in about 71, 72. Started wrestling in 73, I say, and he wrestled up until probably 76. He teamed in Mobile more with Ricky than he did Buddy or Marshall. You know, like I said, Buddy would wrestle as Buddy Carson, and then sometimes he'd wrestle as Marshall Fields. But Buddy never did much more than referee. I think they did more up in Tennessee together. And then after Buddy left up there, they brought Ricky in and, you know, pushed them as the second coming of the Fields brothers. And they did real well up that way for a while. And then, of course, Ricky worked up until, when was he in here, Bobby, 79? 79, 80,
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah, and then his last hurrah was right after Bill Watts started running, split off from McGurk, was running Mid-South. He and Terry Lathan worked down there as a tag team. And then that was pretty much it. And then Ricky quit the business.
Yeah. Huh.
Okay. Oh,
now,
one
Bobby,
thing.
Go ahead.
Can I change the subject just a moment? Curtis Smith called me this afternoon. Y'all know who Curtis Smith is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he says that Bob Kelly was real sick.
Yeah, he's battling cancer right now. He's had some fluid on his lungs, and he's gone through two chemo treatments, and they've left him kind of sick and a little weak, but they think that they're going to be able to get him in remission with the chemo. I think they've got him scheduled for 5 altogether. And other than the pain from that, the fluid has gone off his body, and he's actually doing fairly well. But, you know, after Bob's been in such a bad shape after losing his wife, Chris, that, you know, I worry more about his will to fight it than anything else. But he's doing okay. He's hanging in there. I purposefully didn't call him and tell him about Ken Lucas because of, you know, everything he's battling on his own. I didn't want to lay that in his lap. So
I apologize for interrupting with that problem.
Oh, no, not a problem at all. Not a problem at all.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we've been mentioning Bob on the show for the last two or three weeks, and we just didn't start off with that tonight because of the Ken Lucas situation. So, actually, we appreciate you bringing it up.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And also, Bill Bowman, he's back in the VA home right now, but he was in the hospital for a few days last week with pneumonia. But he seems to be on the mend from that and is back at the nursing home. My friend Elliot Wiggins went and saw him Sunday and everything, so he seems to be doing better. But that's another one we need to keep in our thoughts and prayers, because that's another good man there that I certainly don't want to receive that phone call anytime
right.
soon.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I don't want to leave y'all holding the bag or anything, but I've got to get off here too.
All right. That's like I appreciate you joining us. It was a pleasure to have you on.
I certainly appreciate the opportunity, and it's an honor for me to have the opportunity to be on the show. And as far as the wrestling business is concerned, I have no animosity against no. And I repeat that, no one in the wrestling business. I appreciate everyone that I ever was around, wrestled, or whatever, you know, and I think the Mobile Reunion has a great slogan there where friendships are renewed and grudges are forgotten. I think that's wonderful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jerry, you have a good evening.
That's why they call Jerry the Tennessee Gentleman, just like
that's right. And he's from right. Dyersburg, not Kingsport.
Not Kingsport, Dyersburg.
Jerry, this is Bobby. Would you do me a favor, sir, when you get off the phone?
What's that, sir?
Would you give Miss Linda a kiss on the cheek and tell her it's from me and tell her I love her?
I'll sure do that. I'm going to walk right in here right now. Hold on just a second.
I would appreciate that very much.
Linda? Hey, Bobby, say hello to her, will you?
I certainly will.
Her, do you mind? Okay.
No.
No, not at all.
Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Linda. Now, you're on the radio now, so be careful what you say.
Like
we
should
have talked to her to begin with. We could have got a lot better stories about Jerry if we had just talked to her in the first place. No, I told him to walk in there and give you a kiss on the cheek and tell him it was from me and to tell you I love you, but I'll tell you myself. I love you, darling.
Well, I love you, too.
Hi, Linda. This is Scott.
Once again, gentlemen, I thank you very much. All of you.
All right, Jerry. Appreciate it.
Good night,
Jerry.
Good night.
Good night, Jerry.
Goodbye.
You know, that's a show we ought to do. We ought to have the wrestlers' wives on a show one night. Of course, all the guys would probably wouldn't want to do the show with us after we went through that.
Oh, boy. Bobby, did you remember Jerry coming into Atlanta there?
I refereed Jerry and Buddy Wayne. First time I met Jerry Barber, he came down. We ran Anniston, Alabama out of the Atlanta office. We did a joint deal with Nick. We ran it. Charlie Smith promoted it. We went over there at the Civic Center in Anniston, Alabama, and they sent Jerry down to sit in on the checkup, to get a copy of the report and so forth. And I went over and ran the town. Charlie promoted it, and I went over and ran the town for the office. And that was the first time I ever met Jerry. And then, of course, I was still refereeing some at the time, and Jerry and Buddy Wayne came into Atlanta. They both came in on the same day. One worked one tape, and the other one worked the other tape. And they both worked with the Sheik.
Ooh.
And matter of fact, in Mobile a few years ago, I took a picture down. I had a picture of Buddy Wayne, and I had a picture of the Sheik, both of them in the camel clutch, and one of them had the snake wrapped around him, if I remember right. But anyway, I took the pictures down to him, and Buddy Wayne said, I gave Buddy the picture, and I said, here, man, I said, just something you might want, and he was looking at it, he was talking about it. We were standing there talking, and he goes, well, who's the referee in this picture? Well, I kind of know him. But, yeah, I remember that was those were the only times I remember them coming in and working, but they both came down on the same day.
Yeah. Interesting. Did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Yeah, we're here.
Okay.
We asked that question a lot. You know, Scott, something that you had mentioned about when you retire and you're going to do all these things, let me just clue you in here a little bit. I retired from the government in 2009, and I had all these visions of what I was going to do when I retired. And honestly, I've got less time to do the things I tried to do before I retired than I do now. And I'm not making any money for it either. But the thing is, you know, start planning ahead now for what you want to do, because you'll be surprised at how many things that you thought you didn't have to do after you retired that you were still going to have to do.
Yeah. Well, I stay so busy now, even with my job, man. When I get off work, I'm on this computer either writing books or taking orders for books or one thing or another. But I spend a good, I'd say, 2.5 hours a day working on wrestling-related writing or whatever. And that's I don't think I'm going to have a problem finding time to do it. That's exactly what I plan to do. So I'm excited about it. It'll be here before I know it. I have a friend that retired about 3 years ago, and he said the last year you work, it just flies by. Of course, when you retire, it flies by, too. They say your life just takes off.
When are you actually planning on retiring?
End of next year.
Okay.
End of 2015. And I'll spend my time writing books. I've got so many lined up right now, it's unbelievable.
Well, I'm going to throw another one at you. I know you've done territorial results, like for Mobile and Madison Square Garden and stuff like that. Have you ever done results for one individual wrestler?
Oh, yeah. You mean as far as like a record book? Oh, an actual book?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm considering doing one for Don Fargo. You wouldn't believe right now his results record. I'm working with a guy named Jim Rerwine out of California. Man, this guy's a workhorse, and he's been helping me the past year, and I write him, I say, I'm getting ready to do a interview with so-and-so guy, and man, I send him what results I have, and then he gets digging, and between two of us, we come up with records. But the Fargo record right now stands by 256 pages. It's unbelievable.
Well, I've got another one for you that I'm in the process. Of course, it's going to take me until I'm, you know, pretty much healed and able to get to, you know, have a place of my own and get all my material in front of me. I have 147 pages on Ken Lucas, full
wow,
cards
dude,
of every card he worked on, except it starts in October of 60, so I don't have anything from his Pittsburgh days or, of course, his South Pacific, and I don't know that I would ever be able to. But there's a lot of gaps in the Mobile territory that I can fill in, and, you know, back when he came in with Southeastern.
Well, Jim and I have been working on Lucas because – my plan was, Ken and I have talked several times about it, we were planning to either do a book or a real detailed long interview with him, and of course it's too late for that now, but
right.
We've been working on his ring record. Sometime tomorrow I'll send you what I've got on him, and maybe it'll fill
okay.
some holes.
Okay, well,
the
bulk of mine came from Jim Zordani. I don't know if you know him or not.
Oh,
and,
he's awesome.
Because I had asked him to do one back in 2009, and I'd forgotten that he did it. And I happened to come across it. Somebody posted the link on a message board in a conversation about Ken, and I went and looked through it, and I thought, yeah, I remember starting this now. But it was 11 pages worth, and it goes up to right about the end of 83. I think he worked a little longer than that, but... I'm not sure, but there are a lot of gaps. Of course, it'll never be totally complete, but, you know, there's a lot of gaps that can be filled in. And you probably have some Tennessee stuff that's probably missing, because I know he worked in Knoxville for Fuller prior to Fuller buying Mobile, but there was nothing listed there.
Knoxville's a funny thing. I hope Bo James will bring something out, because it's just not a lot of Knoxville results other than, you know, when you get to 1978, yeah, we can find stuff, but, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, there's really not a whole lot of stuff.
Speaking of Bo James, I'm going to get him here on the line with us. He is currently working on Kingsport results, and he's gone back all the way into the 19-teens. I think his first book he's going to focus on the 60s. Let me get him on with us.
Well, he's an old man in a young man's body, so he's probably been around since about the teens.
You know who said that, don't you, bro? You recognize
exactly.
That voice.
I actually started 20 years ago doing the results for Kingsport. I started.
You sure do work slow.
What's that?
I said you sure do work slow.
Yeah, I do. You know, between producing TVs and making towns, I don't have a lot of free time. Other than getting yelled at by my wife, but that's all right. So, but I started today doing the teens in the 20s and found some great stuff. Actually found some Knoxville stuff, heard Scott talking about it, and I've got to call Joey Kazan and ask him this because I found where they were running Knoxville on Wednesday night.
Huh.
And I had never heard it run any other day than Friday night because Kazan only ran 2 days a week. He'd run Knoxville on Friday and then a spot show on Saturday.
Wow.
And I don't know why they were there. Joey Kazan has all the record books of his granddad, and I have been trying to get him to put those in book form for 2 decades.
Wow!
So people could see them.
Oh yeah, that'd be a great resource for people, you know, who are doing research and stuff.
He has the attendance figures and the payoff sheets too.
Wow!
So I don't know if that's first count or second count, but. But he's got them. So I got to say this real fast. Been reading the Fargo book, and Scott needs a big pad on the back because that's
absolutely.
A lot. You know, there's a lot of work. You know, it's Fargo's life story, but you know, Scott had to go back and find the actual dates and the newspaper clippings and all the stuff that's in there. And trust me, I know how long that takes. And
yeah,
you know, just enjoying the book.
I've been highly offended by some of the stuff I've read. That kind of, people don't live like that.
Yeah, but I used to think that myself.
It only took me 15 minutes with Charlie Smith in Savannah, Georgia to realize people did live like that.
here's a big thing. You were talking about the results and how stuff is hard to find. We are the last group of people that care.
That's right.
About what the wrestling business was. And
yep.
If we don't do it and get it done, there's not going to be any history. Because
right.
Whoever lives longest is going to write history, and they're not going to write it correctly.
Exactly right. There's a few people out there that are younger that may pick up the ball, but I just don't see anyone really having the passion that we do to record this. It's like Ken Lucas passing away. It breaks my heart because he was a close friend for years, but there's another side to it is that I missed telling, really getting Ken's actual story down, you know, his real story, and it tears me up because the problem with the wrestling business is it was so kayfabe, it was so secretive that people just refused to, write these stories down, so there's no history at all. It's like I said at Cauliflower Alley many years ago. I stood up in front of everybody and I told everybody there. I said to the wrestlers, I had all the historians stand up, and I told the wrestlers, I said, if it weren't for these people here, you wouldn't have any history. And I'm hoping that there are some young people that will pick it up, but I don't know if anybody's going to have the passion that we do to have it, to do that, you know, so that because when these guys are gone, the stories are gone. John Solos passed away. Nobody ever did it.
People always come along and they find something that they're attracted to, and they may find the interest in it. And I don't think that'll be the problem, But what the problem's going to be is that it's going to be second-handed information or third-handed information. It's not going to be anybody that's going to actually have been there that can document it from that standpoint. And so from that standpoint, like you said, if it's not done now, it's not going to get done.
That's a good point because. What is true and what's not? As much research as I do, I am always getting my hands slapped by J. Michael Kenyon. I mean, that guy, he finds stuff that I sit there with my jaw. You know, he'll send me 10 pages. I'll ask him a question about, like one time I asked him a question about Al Haft and the Columbus Ohio wrestling office. He sent me like 10 pages of stuff, and I just wanted to answer to one little simple question. But it was great. I mean, wonderful stuff. But I ask him all the time, I said, where do you keep getting this stuff? Because it's all digital. I don't know if he's spent his life just writing and typing stuff in on his computer, but, man, he has more stuff than you would ever believe. And he was a big help to me on Fargo's book as far as back, you know, with Morris Siegel back in Texas and Fred Kohler in Chicago and Jack Pfeffer and J. Michael Kenney, I can't say enough, but even as much research and as careful as I am, there is stuff all the time that slips into my writing that I think is a fact because I've heard it for so many years, but they're not. They're just, it's stuff that's just been carried on, but they're incorrect, and that's going to be the problem because people read this stuff on the internet and they think all these so-called facts are true, and in a lot of cases they're not.
And another thing yes. that we've mentioned is the fact that the business is so secretive.
Jay, hold that thought. I got another Tennessean needs to get on here with us. Uh-oh. Buddy Wayne's finally with us. Good evening, Buddy. How are you?
Hey, go ahead.
Oh, you missed Jerry Barber. He just dropped off about 10 minutes ago. But
okay.
Want to welcome you back to the show. We had so many compliments of you doing our show before. It was a sitting ovation you got, and we had to have you for a return engagement. So welcome back.
I appreciate it.
How you feeling,
go ahead,
buddy?
Jay, what you were saying.
Oh,
I'm doing okay.
Let's see if I can remember now. It's been 2 minutes ago. The fact that the business is so secretive and was so secretive that makes it another problem as far as documenting what was the truth and what wasn't, because one person's truth was another person's not truth. And so if you weren't there, you start second-guessing yourself as a historian as to, can I really use this or not? Because, you know, if you weren't there, it's hard to document the facts sometimes. But if you were there, then at least you can go on your own recollection.
Right.
Yeah, the wrestlers were there, but a lot of times that's not true either.
Right.
Yeah.
But these next generations, they're not going to have that benefit.
That's right. That's it. That's as we lose these guys, and we're losing them so quickly now, it's sad.
Very true, very true.
You know, talking about stories you hear. Years ago, when Elvis was younger, he came to the matches one night. Now, this is a story that has been completely turned around. And he was in the dressing room, and Mario Galletto was there. And Mario says, I'm going to get me some publicity. He went over and got a wrist lock on him and was going to break his arm. And Roy Welch saw it. And he said, you son of a bitch, let him go. And he let it go. And that's what happened. But I've heard, I ain't going to call the name, Scott will know what I'm talking about. One guy said he was there. And Roy comes in and says, go over there and get that son of a bitch off of him. And that didn't happen. That didn't happen. Now, he was going to try to break his arm. But Roy wouldn't have called anybody to help him because he was a tough old son of a gun. And he'd have hit it with that dang cane. You know, he had a, you know, like a walking cane. He had a bad hip, knee, I believe it was. But anyway, maybe it was hip, I don't know. But he no more told that guy to go over and get him off of Elvis or nothing. Also, Mr. Coffey said Elvis used to come to the Coliseum a lot and Elvis Auditorium and watch wrestling. That didn't happen either. The only time he came down there was that one time I just mentioned, and that was a long time ago. But you hear all these stories, you know. I don't know why, but you said a while ago, you hear one thing, then all of a sudden it blows into 10 times that day.
Yeah, that's true.
I know I don't know exactly what year, Elvis just had one record out. And Les Wolf, who was a promoter in Memphis, every Christmas had a benefit for the American Legion and I believe it was the Oddfellas or something like that, sponsored. And he had to go to different people down there. Like, for example, Elvis was there. He said that one record out. Willie Mitchell, who was a heck of a, he had, in fact, he had a number one rhythm and blues band in the world 2 years in a row for the Billboard. And he also produced all of Al Green, not the wrestler, the singer, all of his albums and records. And he was a millionaire. And he had one of the best bands you ever heard. Anyway, Willie would be there, and I don't remember who all. And I know me and Elvis was over by the door talking. And this Bonhoeffer was working for the sheriff's department. And he come up and was talking to us. And he goes, "Elvis, you need to buy you a big Cadillac to get around here." I thought, "You dumb son of a gun." And Elvis says, "Sir, I have two already." And I thought, God, I can't believe that, you know. And I'll tell you something else. You know why Elvis wore his shirt collar turned up?
No.
Does anybody know?
Uh-uh.
Because he had pimples on the back of his neck. And he turned
really?
That shirt up where you could. Yeah. Because I remember that night I noticed. I thought, dang, he's got a lot of little pimples on his neck. But that's the reason he wore it turned up so you couldn't see it.
See, now, people listening to this show tonight have learned something that they didn't think they were going to learn.
exactly.
Listening.
That's funny. All the ones that didn't tune out when they thought it was a baseball show.
So what?
All the ones that didn't tune out when they thought they were had tuned into a baseball show at the beginning of the program.
Okay.
Well, we had to talk about the Atlanta Braves a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
That was a tradition. Atlanta Braves and Georgia Championship Wrestling, that was all TBS had. That and Slim Whitman commercials and Zamfir with the pan flute.
And Bill Tush. And they were all...
Do you know what made Ted Turner Superstation the station that it was? Does anybody know what caused him to be as big as he was?
What's that?
Wrestling.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah.
In that book, I don't know if you ever read his book or not. It ain't as easy as it looks. It's a real good book about, you know, Ted Turner's, you know, life and all. And in that book, he said wrestling is what put him on the map, as they say. Because, you know, back then, a lot of stations, you know, wrestling was a big thing back in the 50s. And even though we didn't have TV in the 50s, that was what we called the golden era of wrestling. They call it sometime now, but that ain't the golden era. That was the golden era. I know Buddy Rogers said one time, they would go to town of 15,000 people, and they'd have 15,000 people at the matches. It was unreal, sometimes what you drew in these towns. It was fantastic. I know there was a little Mexican named Gordo Chihuahua. He was from Mexico, naturally, being a Mexican. And he couldn't speak any English. He weighed about 240 and about 5'7" or 5'8", maybe. And one night, this is what really made him get over. We had a TV program in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And I had a lot of spot shows running around there. And Chihuahua come out while I was doing an interview. Well, I wrestled a week or two earlier. And when he come out, he couldn't speak any English. I don't know what he was doing coming out. I guess he thought he was supposed to come out and wrestle. But when he come out, I got a chair, and I picked it up, and I figured, he come up, I'm going to whack it with this chair. Well, the dead-gum chair got hung up in the curtain. And when he come forward, I pulled it down, and when I did, it knocked the heck out of him. It bent that metal folding chair. I thought, oh, my Lord, and he just staggered back. Didn't even go to his knees. And I said, oh, my Lord. He didn't even go to his knees on that. And it looked like his eyes crawled. Anyway, he turned around and went back to the dressing room. We went to a little town the next night. I think we have a decent house. I got there, and we turned people away.
Wow.
I mean, they couldn't believe it. They said, we got to see this guy. Because it bent that metal chair. I mean, I knocked the heck out of him. And the only reason he didn't bust his head open, he had a lot of hair on top of his head. And I asked Nick Doulas when I first saw him, if I could use him in a lot of my towns. And Lester Wells said, if you make a nickel with him, you'll be lucky. Well, I was real lucky because I made a bunch of nickels with him. He sold out a lot of places. And then if he'd have fell to his knees, they wouldn't have hit nothing. But it didn't even but I mean, he just staggered back. So that's how sometimes things happen, you know, for the good, as you would say, as far as making money, that is.
Funny how something simple like that would draw money too back then. You didn't have to do fireworks.
Yeah, guys could work on angles, you know, and really put a lot into it and maybe not get as much out of it as what you just did right there.
Yeah, exactly. But when that thing hung in the curtain, and I'm sweating, you know, pulling that thing, and when it come loose, then it came loose. And it knocked the heck out of here. I can see that in my mind right now. Putting that camera on the chair.
What is that?
I heard me in the background 2 minutes later, so I don't
know. What is it going on?
You were talking about Ted Turner and the TV station. We moved the ring in the middle of the night. We were way before the Baltimore Colts. Ray Gunkel did not tell Channel 11 he was leaving. Me and Larry Nichols went down to Channel 11 in the middle of the night and moved the ring down to Channel 17, which was only about 10 blocks. And this was like on a Sunday night, Monday night. I can't remember exactly when we did it, but first taping at 17 was on Saturday. So I show up about 8 o'clock in the morning to put the TV ring up. I can't get in the building. All the doors are locked. I pound on doors, knock on doors. I cannot get anybody to come to the door to let me in. So I took my pocket knife and I jimmied the back door to the TV station and got in. And I'm thinking, you know, I probably set some kind of alarm off. I had no idea. I'd only been in the station one time, and it was in the middle of the night, and we had come through the front door, the garage door, the front. So I have no idea where I'm at, so I'm wandering around this TV station, and I just kind of go toward where I'm hearing noise. And back then, when Turner first started, all he showed was movies. He had no local programming at all. We were the first local program he ever produced. I cut back in, and I finally make my way into the control room. Now, it's 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning. There's a guy sitting at the control. There's one guy in the whole building. He's sitting at the control panel running the commercials during this movie. He is barefooted. He's got one foot up on the console, the other foot, his legs are crossed. He's playing a guitar, and he's smoking a joint. That was my introduction to Channel 17. And I told the guy, I said, I'm here to put the TV ring up. He said, hey, man, knock yourself out. And I went out and put the ring up. So that's how that started. And it grew, and we talked earlier about the baseball, about the great technical team that he started amassing and started building there. But when we started, that's what it was. He had two cameras, and the technical end of it was Ed Caprell had pictures of everybody that was on the card in Atlanta Friday night, and he'd put the baby faces on one easel, and he'd put the heels on another easel, and my job was to flip the picture on whichever easel I was working when they would go to the other picture.
Well, you know, you talk about different things in TV. Years ago, I had a TV program in Greenville, Mississippi. The studio was actually between Greenwood and Greenville at that time. And I got down there on Sunday. We had a tape we played in there. And I go down sometime on Sunday and do a live interview. Well, I got down there one Sunday afternoon. There wasn't, but when you mention one person, there wasn't but one person there. And all he did was just play the tapes. And he said, well, we can't do an interview. I said, why? He said, well, we can get nobody to do it. I said, yes, we can, too. I said, okay, this is the control room. You can see where the studio was. You'll do the interview. I said, let me go out there and get on that. You come out there, too, while this is playing. Set the camera up. So we can sit down and put two chairs. I set one of them. I said, oh, you got me? He said, yeah, so let me go to the next one. I said, you got it over here, too? He said, yeah. I said, okay, here's what we'll do. I'll be sitting here by myself. This is the boy that's running the tapes now. I said, I'll be sitting here. When you go to the clue, just cue me, and I'll start it. And you come out and join me. So here's what we did. So I'm sitting there. He opened up. I said, I don't remember what all I said, but, you know, run down the card. Well, this boy, I forget his name, come out and sit down. He said, buddy, can I join you? I said, yeah, come on, man. Glad to have you. He said, you got a big car tomorrow night. So we sat there and did that little interview, if you want to call it that, whatever. So when he said, well, look, I got to get on back. So really enjoyed being there. I said, okay. So he goes back, gets back in the control room, and I wind it up. He gives it a cue. We go off. You know, we're off. So when you say, well, you can't do it, we can do it. And we did. We didn't have anybody in there but that one boy.
But if it weren't perfect, you know, it weren't perfect. You got to be creative in this business.
Yep. That's true.
Can you imagine running something like that by Vince McMahon today? See what he
yeah, right. About? Yeah. Well, we did a lot of stuff, you know. I know one night in Columbus, Mississippi, we always did interviews after our matches on Monday night. And Phil Golden was promoting it then. And we went out there, and they didn't have anybody to work the camera. And I said, and he said, well, we can't do it tonight. We got no cameraman. I said, wait a minute. Come here and show me something. So he showed me how to work that camera. I said, well, let me practice a little bit with it. So we did, and I was the cameraman. And then when we would do my interview, I don't remember somebody else got behind the camera and did it, you know. So, you know, like I said, you got to improvise.
You did what you had to do.
Exactly.
And you probably learned as much about working the camera right there under that pressure as you would if somebody, you know, just in their off time would spend an hour and a half trying to teach you.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you another thing that happened to us one time. The tape we used in Greenwood is the same tape we used in Jonesboro. Well, we followed our match a week later in Greenville. You know, it's the same card. Well, we'd make two interviews, one for Jonesboro and one for Greenville. And in Jonesboro, we'd bypass the Greenville tape, you know, the interview that is. And then in Greenville, we'd bypass the Jonesboro tape. So anyway, one night in Greenville, I got down there, and all these people was talking about the match in Jonesboro coming up. I thought, how in the world do they know about that match? And they said, man, we're going to be there. And that's 150, maybe right at 200 miles from Memphis, Jonesboro to Greenville. And I said, how do you know about that match? It was on TV. Well, what happened? The boy wasn't paying no attention. He played the Jonesboro interview, too. I said, well, no, we do now. And can you believe I had about four carloads of people that drove to Jonesboro from Greenville for that match?
Wow.
It sure did. And we tell people come from Dobbsville, Missouri to Jonesboro every Saturday night, about 100 miles away, about three carloads. We got people from way off coming, not just right in town, but, you know, from all the little towns. But we're talking about way back to 60s now, you know.
Well, you know, that was one of the things at the time. You promoted for the local area, and that was your bread and butter. But in reality, that was before cable and everything else. If some of the fans had known about what was going on in other places, other than the fact that you might be giving away your finishes, they would have traveled easily those distances to go to those matches, you know?
Yeah, but if you just, I tell you, we did so many things back then that today people say, oh, that's crazy. Well, we may have been crazy, but we made money.
Right.
We made money. I know one time I was telling somebody, I don't know who it was, Jerry Lawler. We was at the matches, and I said something about handling the first three or four matches. And he said, oh, buddy, what you did back a few years ago, you can't do now, I won't draw. I said, Jerry, now this was after we left the Coliseum and went out to that flea marketplace. And I said, Jerry, look out there. What we're doing now ain't drawing. What we did then, this draw, it would draw again. But, you know, it's like, well, we can't do it. I never will forget. One night, I may have mentioned this last week, Jared and I was talking, and I said something about the Famous Ones was killing our towns, our spot shows. They'd go in and do all this silly crap, and, you know, have people laughing, and you don't draw money being funny, as they used to say. But anyway, Jared put his hand on my shoulder, said, but if we don't change, we'll be out of business. So we changed, and what happened? We went out of business because we was drawing money. And, you know, so it, you know, like Joe said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
That's true.
That's very true.
Well, you know, things can be improved. There's always ways of doing that, but it doesn't mean you got to throw out everything and start all over again.
You know, I was watching Hee-Haw the other night. Well, actually, it wasn't Hee-Haw. It was Ralph Emery's show, and Roy Clark was on there. And they were talking about Hee-Haw. And one of the things that killed Hee-Haw, they tried to change. Because Roy said, what happened? They used to have the pretty girls laying on the porch, and the old hound dogs laying on the ground. Y'all, if you watch Hee-Haw, you know what I'm talking about. And so they decided to go try to get a younger bunch of people. So they put a bus stop up. with some stuff. And they said, can you imagine how stupid it looked? Junior Samples and Grandpa Jones out there in front of a bus, in a truck, at a bus stop. And, Roy Park said, he said that very same thing. If it ain't broke, why are you trying to fix it?
Hee-Haw was a very successful show. And,
it was.
CBS decided it was too hayseed, and after, 2 years, they dropped it from the network, and then it lasted another 25 years in syndication.
Right.
Yep.
That's what Roy Clark was saying on that Ralph Emmett interview. That's on every week on that, I think it's called RFD cable or something or another. I don't know what channel it would be where y'all are, but Memphis on cable, Comcast at 2:58 on Sunday at 7 o'clock. At, I'm sorry, 5 o'clock. And then the Country Union. But to know your older country music artists, and when you look at it, man, a lot of them are dead now. A whole bunch of them are dead.
Wow.
But they're older tapes, you know, they're not real recent. But I watch them every Sunday.
Huh. Bobby saw Junior Samples up close and personal one night, didn't you, Bobby?
Charlie Smith promoted Cumming, Georgia, and I went up there under a mask and wrestled Ted Allen. And Junior Samples was sitting on the front row. And Charlie said whoever was supposed to be in the main event didn't, hadn't showed up, so I want to know if we could put some time in. And so Charlie was refereeing, and we kept on and on and on. And finally I got Charlie tickled somewhere or another. I was healing. And Charlie, he was laughing, and I finally just kind of got indignant with him, backed up in the corner, and I said, look, I said, man, there is 10,000 comedians out of work, just like that fat man right there. And I said, you're trying to be funny. And son, he come up off the front row with a pocket knife in his hand, and I went to the other side of the ring and told Charlie, I said, don't you let him in here on me. Yeah, what
Roy
you saw
Clark.
Junior Samples
Roy.
Was what you got. That wasn't no work. That was him.
No, you're right.
Yeah, that's what Roy Park said on that interview the other day. Said that he was exactly like that. And when he stumbled over the words, trying to pronounce them, he wasn't doing it on purpose. He was actually couldn't pronounce them, you know.
Yeah. I got tickled. They interviewed Junior Samples one time, and they said, Junior, we understand when you was growing up, you fought a lot. Said, what kind of fighting technique did you use? And he said, I used the cut and run. He said, cut and run. He said, yeah, I'd cut through the woods and run home.
Yeah.
Bo James, what's your plan for your Kingsport research? What do you plan to do?
I think he dropped off. Yeah,
okay,
he dropped
okay.
off. Yeah.
Anybody know what his plans are?
Well, I know he's going to do the first book. I don't know if he's planning on doing a series. I think he may be doing it by decade. But he said, you know, he's starting with the 60s because that's when Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell really, you know, set the town on fire or the territory on fire. But what he's stumbling over is all the different promoters. He said he found something where somebody was suing Mickey Barnes and Ron Wright because Ron had kicked a guy trying to get in the ring and knocked him out. And said in order to get around that, Mickey supposedly sold the territory to Lester Welch. And, of course, that was probably all at work just to keep that from happening. And, that territory passed through so many different hands. So he's just trying to line up who promoted when. And trying to locate some of the buildings that, pinpoint where they either still standing or where they were. But I think that's his plan, is to at least start with the decade of the 60s.
Yeah, I sent him some results last week that I stumbled across. And it was Kingsport in the 40s, and it gave him actually something he had been looking for some time, which was a starting date for when they first started promoting Kingsport, so it gave him it helped him a bunch this past week where he could go out.
He said, even though he's not going that far back as far as his books go, he may eventually, but he was getting results from the 19-teens and 20s, and there was a guy that was the big star in there. It was billed as the Kingsport Flash or something like that, and his name was Tony Bernardi. And he called me this afternoon and asked me if I'd ever heard of him. And I said, well, let me look. And I thumbed through, and sure enough, I had a photo of him. And then he said he later was known as Tex Hager. And I said, well, Tex Hager ran, you know, out in the Iowa and Montana and places like that. He was the promoter out there for many years. I had no idea they were the same guy, but I looked at, compared the pictures, and they were, because I've got pictures of Hager, too.
Wow.
Me and Charlie Smith went up, I guess it's been 2 months ago, maybe, I guess two, 3 months ago. Me and Charlie went up and spent the weekend up in Kingsport. Bo went up for Bo's TV taping, and we also went to the first Knoxville, the reincarnation of Southeastern. We went to their first taping in Knoxville on Saturday night. But we went up, and I was just, I kid Bo about being an old man in a young man's body, but he is so old school when it comes to wrestling, and especially Kingsport. He's so avid about it. I mean, he took us over and showed us. He showed us where Mickey Barnes lived and where the wrestling office was. He showed us buildings and places. He showed me where Ron Wright, the house he grew up in. He showed me Whitey Caldwell's house. I mean, he just, you know, he is just so into that stuff. I thought Michael Norris is, you know, Scott and Michael are like dinosaurs in the wrestling business, because all they do is sit on the computer all day and stare at pictures and write. And every time I go on Michael, look in the room and see if Michael's okay, he's on a computer looking at pictures. But, you know, I'm glad we got guys. I got to say, second what Jay said earlier, I'm glad we got guys like this that are recording this stuff, because I mean, I got a good memory about stuff when I come up as a kid, about finishes I saw and things I saw and people that I seen. But, you know, as far as being able to just recall this stuff and look it up and have it documented like they do, I don't have it. And I'm just really proud that I'm associated with you guys, and that you guys keep this stuff alive in my head. And there's plenty of room in there these days for it to bounce around.
So tell me, Bobby, you believed it when Michael said he was looking at pictures of wrestlers, right, on the computer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing, Jay, is when I go by there, I see what he's looking at.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I mean, it's just, you know, let me give you a funny story, guys. And this, I'm ashamed to even tell this story, but it's the truth. When my son was 18, he was living with me, and I umpired softball and baseball for 23 years, and my son, when he was 17, he started bugging me wanting to umpire, and I wouldn't let him do it to begin with. And my reasoning was, I said, you know, I have a bit of a reputation, and I'm not going to put you out there, and you're not going to destroy what I've built up. Long story short, finally let him start umpiring, and he's better at it than I ever was. He's 38 now, and he's still doing it. He's calling high school baseball. But when he was 18, he wanted a telephone in his room, so I got him a telephone. I put it in my name, gave him the phone. He had his own number, and I thought, well, you know, this is good. You pay the bill, we're good. First couple of months, things went well. About the third month, the bill came in, and the bill was $400-something. And I opened the bill up, and I looked at it, and there's three pages of 800 numbers. Now, the first thing went through my mind was, you know what went through my mind.
Yes.
He's done got hooked up on one of these, call Sally at 1-800, and she'll talk dirty to you on the phone. So I thought, well, you know, so for my own knowledge to see what it was, I dialed the number to see what it was. Fellas, he was calling Ted Turner's 1-800-WRESTLE number.
My goodness.
And they would give you about 90 seconds of some, you know, Gene Okerlund would give you 90 seconds of something, and then he would give you just a tease, and then it would end. And you'd have to call back to get the next part of it. And he spent $400, and I'll never forget sitting him down at my kitchen table and telling him if he would give me a dollar a minute, I'd tell him anything he wanted to know. But yeah, that was, you know.
Probably would have been cheaper to talk to Sally.
Yes, it would have. He'd have probably got more out of it.
Well, guys, we are just about out of time. And Bo's back on with us. Scott was asking what your plans are with the research you've done. You want to give us a quick rundown on what your plans are?
Yeah, the first book will be 60 to 69, and then I'll back up to the 50s, and then probably do the 70s third. I'm actually started looking today, and from the 20s to 40s, there's probably a book there, too.
He didn't run every week then. The teens and 20s, it looked like Kingsport run 4 or 5 times a year. And then 31s when they opened the office here, Pete Moore and Jim Crockett. And then Crockett went to Charlotte, and Pete Moore stuck around, and Charlotte Crockett came back in 39 and bought it. So, matter of fact, I sent you a Facebook message yesterday, Scott, asking you a question. So if you get a chance, check that out.
Okay, I sure will.
Well, Scott, buddy, appreciate you guys joining us. Thanks to again, Jerry Barber. And, Bo, you're always welcome here. You know that. You have a home here anytime you want to be on.
Well,
and,
I appreciate that.
I'm just sorry we've run out of time, but we'll definitely have all you guys on again. This is a conversation we could probably do 2 or 3 more shows on, the history of Tennessee, and just not just the Welches, but Tennessee in general and everything. And we'll definitely try and plan another program. Just to give you a quick note what I'm planning for next week, Bobby J., I'm planning on doing a show on TV production and how it worked and how it was different in each territory and what was good, what wasn't so good, and so forth and so on, and kind of get into the nuts and bolts about that. So we'll get together next week, and that's what we'll do. So thanks again, everybody.
Enjoy. Good night, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoyed it.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.